found this on Ganarum. Ganamir Ni.
What is it?
Well, it's. It's a performance.
Welcome to Synthaholics, guys. This is your host, David Duncan, and with me as always...
The Grand Nagus himself, Aaron O'Brien. Inconceivable!
Inconceivable neck. we're here a little over a week after since we recorded our last podcast. That was on First Contact Day, and...
We're going back! We're gonna go back in time.
See, that's the great thing about time loops. We can just go back in time whenever we need to. As we mentioned, we were recording on First Contact Day. Friend of mine, Frank Wu, who was on our Facebook page, he was like, "Oh, I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys think about First Contact." And I'm like, well, "We're not actually talking about First Contact. We're talking about the future of Star Trek, because without First Contact, there would be no future."
That's right.
So he was like, "Oh, you know, I'd love to hear what you guys think about." The episode Changeling and First Contact and the character of Zefram Cochrane. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today.
Actually, we're going to talk about Metamorphosis.
Metamorphosis?
Yeah, not Changeling. That's a different one.
But it's like the same word, right? Like, it's like Metamorphosis, yeah. Changeling? Yeah. It's Metamorphosis.
Yes. We are talking about the subject of the character of Zefram Cochrane. He is the... man who discovered and went into warp speed, the first of the human race.
Kind of.
Well.
Because.
We'll get into that too later on. He got a little help from his friends. But so he was the guy who started it all off. And got us to go up into the stars and reach different planets at higher velocities that we wouldn't be able to do. So, real quickly, should we just talk about warp speed, just to give everybody an idea what warp actually is?
Aye, aye, Captain.
All right. So, warp speed technically is... Now, the idea of space, traveling space is immense. There's no way, even with... If you could go... super duper duper fast, close to light speed, it would still take you hundreds of years just to reach the next, you know, the next solar system close by. I mean, it would be an immensely boring show.
I want to say it's like 5 years to get to Alpha Centauri, which is the nearest star. So, if we're moving at the speed of light,
well, which is physically impossible.
So we have to move at like 90% of the speed of light. So that would take like, you know. 7 years.
Right.
Something
so,
like that.
But it would take a very long time. And then just to, like you said, Alpha Centauri or even like a stars beyond, it would just be ridiculous. So the show would be boring. So what they came up with the idea of warp drive. And the idea behind warp drive is that warp actually creates a warp field around the ship. It becomes like a bubble. And that bubble kind of negates the idea of the gravity displacement of the ship. And that way, it can speed through space a lot quicker.
It also prevents the time displacement that you would get by traveling at the near the speed of light, or at the speed of light, because, you know, if you're a fan of the original Charlton Heston Planet of the Apes, that's basically the idea of that, is that they're traveling as close as they can to the speed of light. They've only been gone for like 20 years, and thousands of years have passed on Earth. And if our Star Trek ships moved like that, then...
They'd come back to Earth, and it'd be like there'd be monkeys there, and next time there'd be like, you know, strange cockroaches running the place. So it would be it really wouldn't work for the show. So that's what warp drive. And just a side note to all this, there is now a lot of theories out there that there's that the scientists believe that warp capabilities is possible. There are some theories in math, and they've yet to test them, of course. But it is on the drawing table someday if we ever have enough space funding.
So basically, we want to, in order to make a real-life warp bubble, you would have to compress space in front of you and then expand space behind you. So it becomes more like a wave rather than a bubble. But, I mean, I'm sure it would still probably look like a bubble in space if you could visualize what space-time looks like.
Right, which we really can't visually, but we can get the idea what it would be like.
And so I think they came up with bubble because that's just easier to think of rather than a surfer wave.
Right, and what we hear in the TV shows and the movies that there's a warp field around the ship. That's how they describe it. So that being said, that's what warp is broken down. Zefram Cochrane created that. He was a man born in Montana or Alpha Centauri. We're not really sure. It's kind of left up to being vague, but we're assuming it has to be Montana.
According to the First Contact, it would have to be.
Yeah, right, exactly. He was born in the in 2030s. We don't really know quite when. And known to be not only the inventor of the warp drive for the human race, but also known as the booze hound of Bozeman, Montana.
He could hold his liquor.
The man could drink. So we're going to go where we first meet Zefram Cochrane. We're going to go actually back to the original series.
Ye old original series.
Ye
and
old.
And Metamorphosis, not Changeling. I do apologize for that mistake earlier, guys.
Yeah, it happens. There was a lot of shows. So we're just going to tell you exactly the rundown of the show. So what happens is we have the beginning of the show. The crew is in the shuttlecraft with Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and they have another charming commissioner from the Federation.
Good thing it wasn't Commissioner Gordon.
I would actually like him to be on there.
But the story wouldn't have worked.
So we have Nancy Hedford. She is the assistant commissioner, and she is trying to prevent war in Epsilon Canaris 3, to the outbreak of war.
And guys, this war is super important. It needs to be stopped like as soon as possible.
Right, but
she is upset about having to go to the Enterprise for this vaccination.
But that's the problem. She accidentally came in contact with somebody, a super rare disease that most people don't actually could ever get, or they don't. Their most immune systems don't get. It's called Sekiro's disease.
It's like a 1 in a million shot of lightning.
Right, so
she's that lucky.
She is lucky, and let me tell you, she is a charming lady, the kind of person that you kind of want to kick out the airlock.
Her voice never raises that high. What are you talking about?
Oh, my God. I don't know how she could prevent a war. I think she'd start a couple wars. So Sekiro's disease, just a couple of things, side notes of that. Side effects, we have serious skin reactions, cardiovascular events, night terrors, insomnia, nervous system disorders, hallucinations, increasing gambling, sexual or overpowering urges, coma, trouble swallowing, and sometimes death.
Well, what I don't get is, like she's got it, right? And she's fine. She doesn't exhibit any of these problems.
Well, it's
and then like all of these manifest like as close together as possible.
Right.
And she's like on her deathbed super quick.
Right. Oh yeah. Well, and not only that, it's like I have all compassion in the world for anybody with the disease, but she was kind of hoping that she would have died in that back room there. But okay, so
she sort of did.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, let's not spoilers. Let's not give it away. So anyway, so they're on the shuttlecraft. They're en route to rendezvous with the Enterprise, and what's going to happen is she's going to get the inoculations for the disease, and then they're going to bring her back. So what happens though, the ship has been taken over, or the controls have been seized by a strange alien. It is called the Companion.
A nice little sparkly cloud. Lots of glitter.
Yes, it's a glittery energy of an alien. And it diverts it to a small planetoid in the Gamma Candris region. So anyways, they come back, they land on the, they're forced to land. They basically have no control of the shuttlecraft. They land and they get out, and while they're checking things out, there's a man going, "Hello, oh, so, I haven't seen people in so long. And here comes a young man comes up to them, and he's so happy to see them. He said he's been marooned there for a long time. And, of course, Kirk wants to find out what's brought them there, why they're there. And basically, this man says there's no way they're ever going to get off the planet. He tells them his name is Cochrane. Well, this is, of course, Zefram Cochrane, the man who invented the warp drive. And this is a good couple hundred years after he created this. So this is a strange thing that they don't really realize at first, that this is actually Zefram Cochrane.
Yeah, they kind of run it by him later just to make sure.
It's like, wait, you're the Zefram Cochrane, right? Like the guy who made the warp drive?
Don't imagine there's too many guys named Zefram running around.
It is the future. So, so anyways, what they find out is that as time progresses, that he is in a friendship, should we say, with the companion, the strange alien. The alien comes to him and kind of like engulfs him, and these twinkly, magically lights kind of like dance around him.
This is how they talk and communicate.
Yeah,
and
some kind of telepathic thought. So, that all being said, obviously Kirk wants to find a way to get off the planet. His first thought is obviously destroy all intelligent life he finds. And he has Spock to try to create some kind of device that's going to, if not subdue it, kill it. Zefram Cochrane has some reservations, but he ends up doing it and he goes along with it. And the plan backfires. It doesn't work. They try to short it out with some kind of electrical device Spock creates. And the companion comes and attacks Kirk and Spock. And by some small mercy, Zefram Cochrane tells him to not kill him. Anyways, all that happens. Meanwhile, our charming commissioner, Nancy Hefford, she is getting more ill as time goes on. She's having a fever.
Very sweaty.
Night terrors. Uncontrollable emotional outbursts.
And voice control.
And maybe some bowel issues, too, but they didn't really go into that in the show. All that being said, McCoy kind of appeals to Kirk not to try to kill it, maybe try to communicate with it. They bring out the universal translator, and
it's a lightsaber, guys.
Well, they don't cut anybody up,
but it's like a giant metal tube, and like it's big, and it's like a light. Looks like a lightsaber.
It does look like a lightsaber.
And George Lucas stole it.
He might have. He stole a lot of things. Stole my lunch. So anyways, they talk to it, and here comes the voice. It is a female voice, and all the while it is basically showing this. It says it brought the Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and Nancy to the planetoid to be companion and friends with Zefram, and they are there to stay. And of course, Kirk's not having it. He's got to get him off the planet. They got to get Nancy off the planet so she doesn't die from her disease and get back to the Enterprise.
And they got to stop this war. This war is such a big thing.
The war is a big thing. Oh, it's huge. It's huge. So, over multiple appeals, they actually get the companion to see the error of its ways, that the humans can't stay on the planet forever. They'll just be, he'll say they'll cease to exist, but I think they just mean they'll just die of depression. And
I think he's implementing that they'll all commit suicide.
Right.
And
right.
Leave the companion alone.
There's not enough green-skinned women for Kirk to go after.
Nope.
And so meanwhile, Nancy's getting closer to death's door, and what the companion decides to do is that takes on the body of Nancy Hefford just before she dies of her illness. And so now the companion is in Nancy's body. She's basically stopped. She no longer has the immense powers. I don't know why that negates it, but because she's in Nancy's body.
Limited by the human form.
Yeah. basically Zefram learns that the companion's in love with him, which he has his issues with.
Well, he had issues whenever the companion was a bunch of sparkles.
Right. He's like, wait.
He's got less of a problem now that he's admitted that...
hey, that thing used that to just, like, used to just run those sparkles all over my body. What a... I thought that was just its...
I thought that was platonic.
I thought that was a handshake. It tingled, and I don't know what to think now.
Because it's made of electricity, so lots of static electricity in that sparkle cloud.
Yeah. So, now that he sees Nancy in the companion of one, he's a little reserved at first, but he comes around, and I think it's just because it's the first time he's seen a woman in, like, 150 years or something like that. So he's just, you know, he'd do anything right now.
Yeah, he's totally ready. And he tells Kirk and everybody, don't come back. We'll be good.
Hey, don't let the door hit you on the ass on the way out. So he does tell him, don't tell anybody. And it kind of makes sense because Zefram Cochrane was an iconic figure for so many people. And I think the idea is that he didn't want people coming back and visiting him and being like, what's the secret of Warp Drive?
Well, you know, I think I want to touch on this again when we actually talk about First Contact. And I think this is like the only part of his personality that carries over between First Contact and here. But we'll talk a little bit more of that after we've talked about First Contact.
Right. And the only thing I can say about this, kind of the disparity between the two characters, is that I would think that, you know, the 100-some years that he was on this planetoid kind of mellowed him out. And I also have a strong belief that it was a dry planet and there was no whiskey whatsoever to be had on the planet.
Oh, that withdrawal period must have been horrible.
He probably had the shakes forever.
But the companion just covered up in swirls and it was okay.
I feel sick to my stomach, but this is nice. So they leave. And the last line of the episode was like, McCoy goes, wait, what about the war on Epsilon 3?
This war is so important, guys.
This war is so, so important. And Kirk's answer is, well, I'm sure we could find some other woman to stop that war.
Just make a hologram of that woman. They won't know the difference.
End scene, credits come up. I mean, it is almost comical how they end it. And I'm like, that's how you end the episode?
It's not the beginning of a two-parter or anything. It's just, nope, not the war. It's inconsequential.
Right. So that is basically the episode of Metamorphoses. It's an interesting episode. It's really not one of my favorites, but it's fun to see the character come be brought on and what they drew from. They basically for First Contact, they went back and drew back from that well and kind of reinvented the character a bit.
Yeah, they did. And let's go over a rundown of First Contact, and I also have some interesting trivia for First Contact that I want to go into.
Interesting, you say?
Yeah, that'll like totally make a different spin on, you know, what we think and know about First Contact. So, First Contact, brand new Enterprise E, and Starfleet tells Picard he can't come fight this Borg ship that's coming to Earth to destroy it.
Oh, because he's compromised.
He's so compromised, they asked him to help out fighting the Borg, like, lots of occasions in Next Generation. But now when Earth's in trouble, you're too compromised to save Earth.
Right. And he's just like, we're tired of you Bogarting it all the time and beating everybody. We got these other captains that want to get a name for themselves, but it's always Picard's beating the Borg, making truce with the Romulans.
Yeah. That's, Picard's already made, you know, his name. He's destroyed an Enterprise. Let's keep this one out of the battle so we can keep this Enterprise, you know, safe for a little while. I think they were really worried about the ship.
Yeah, they're
not really Picard. It's like, oh, man, we just spent all this money that we don't spend.
Listen, guys, we just put a new coat of paint on this thing, so don't...
don't mess it up.
Don't crash it. Don't run into any asteroids.
Don't run into a giant Romulan ship.
Oh. They'll come later. Picard probably just sits around thinking like, how can I smash the ship into something?
No. Deanna Troi's thinking that because she's the one who drove it into the ground.
Oh, she did. She did. But he did come up with a Picard maneuver, which is kind of like flying a ship at warp speed right up to your face and then just unloading all your arsenal into it.
Well, to be fair, that ship was pretty much gone anyway. I mean, yeah, if he did crash it, who cares?
Brand new Enterprise sitting out with the Battle of the Borg.
Anyway, Picard tunes in onto his FM radio and listens to the listens to the battle ensue, and it doesn't sound very good.
No, this news break.
Federation ships are getting torn apart. Picard's like, screw the orders. You know, I'm gonna pull a Kirk and just ignore them.
I love when Starfleet captain just goes, I'm not listening to Starfleet.
He goes in. They go to the Borg cube. There's a spot in the Borg cube. Picard knows he'll destroy it. Everyone's like, that's not gonna do nothing. And he's like, just do it.
Just do it.
They blow up the ship. It spits out a little
little orb, little sphere, Borg sphere.
It would've been funny if it was like a small cube.
And inside the larger box was a smaller box.
Meanwhile, they save Worf off the Defiant, which that was such a waste. They wasted a good chance to use next Deep Space Nine characters. I'm so upset about that. We could have had O'Brien back. I mean, he was originally a TNG guy. You could have had O'Brien back. Could have had Dax. Could have had Kira. I mean, maybe Benjamin, probably not, since Worf was in command, so...
Yeah, but you could have had Jake, and you could have...
Nog! No, not Jake or Nog.
Hey, guys!
Not Jake or Nog, but we could have had, like, you know, O'Brien would have made sense since
O'Brien would have been there.
O'Brien would have made so much sense. And he was basically chief engineer of the Defiant. Why was he not in the movie?
I don't know. Maybe he had something else to do, fix a transporter somewhere.
Deep Space Nine fell apart whenever he wasn't on the station, so...
Every time I leave!
That might have been more important than fighting the Borg, but... And the Defiant gets crippled. The Defiant was built to fight the Borg.
Well, yeah, but it was a heavy battle. That was one big box.
And the Millennium Falcon was at that battle. It just straight in.
Was it really?
Yeah, it's in the background. It's really hard to see. It's really tiny, but the Millennium Falcon was helping fight the Borg cube.
I'm glad to see that Han Solo and Chewie were there.
Trying to save the day. They were trying to steal the light from Star Trek, guys.
Right.
Anyway, they save Worf. Little Borg sphere comes out of the big Borg cube. It goes back in time. They detect some kind of chronotons.
And the Enterprise chases down that rabbit hole.
And then all of a sudden, the world is full of Borg. And then the chronotons flux again, and then they're back in time, and they destroy the Borg sphere after it shoots about, you know, 30 torpedoes into Montana.
Right.
They're trying to stop first contact. They beam down. They assess the damage. Zefram Cochrane's junk off his ass somewhere. He's like...
He didn't even know what happened. He was so drunk. He was all blacked out.
Oh, and his best friend Lily is like, we gotta get to the ship and check it out. And
he's like,
I think he just goes back to the bar.
Yeah, he's like, you check it out, Lily. I got an important meeting to go to. This whiskey
meeting with Jack Daniels
and Captain Morgan.
Anyway, the crew comes down. They assess what's happening. They confront Lily. She passes out when Data jumps three stories and gets filled with a whole bunch of Tommy gun bullets.
That was a cool little move for Data.
Yeah, it was good. But considering an arrow like hurt him a little bit.
Yeah.
In one of those episodes, he's upgraded his skin to body armor.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway. He goes, and they bring Lily back to the ship. Picard stays on the ship. Riker and
Deanna
are basically, and Geordi and Barclay are all. You don't see Barclay till later, but Barclay's there.
He has his little moment.
But because they lose contact with the ship later, so
right.
Barclay's there. So they were trying to find Zefram Cochrane because he wasn't near the ship. So they're like, "What's going on? We gotta find the guy."
He's boozing it up. Meanwhile, up on the Enterprise, unbeknownst to them, that the Borg have somehow got onto the Enterprise, and they are now infiltrating the Enterprise itself. It's very slowly, and now it's a fight to save the Enterprise. And you have to remember, now we're back in the 2060s, so there's no Federation, there are no other starships.
In fact, Earth is pretty much decimated. We just finished World War III, which came on right after the Eugenics Wars.
Right, exactly. So that's the interesting part, is that the world is
basically post-apocalyptic.
It's a shithole. It's not. There's not much to see.
Yeah, or that, you know.
There's no indoor plumbing. You just go in a bucket. So it's not much of a planet right now. I assume that maybe there's some centralized cities, but out in Montana, there's nothing there.
They're so far removed from civilization.
And that Zefram Cochrane has basically cannibalized a missile silo that still had a missile in there, and he's using that to be for his ship, the Phoenix.
Yes. So the Borg take over the ship. Picard guns down some innocent crew members because it's impossible to be saved from being assimilated.
Yeah, that's the sad part. He's got a little anger issues on the Borg. So
no mercy.
No. It is interesting to see the complete flip flop of Picard when he comes into movies.
Yeah.
He's like, whatever we set up before doesn't matter anymore.
If you guys have not seen the Plinkett reviews for the Star Trek The Next Generation movies and the Star Wars prequel movies, they are so worth watching. He goes into the Tale of Two Picards. There's the TV show Picard and the movie Picard. They're very different people.
Right.
So the Borg have taken over the ship. They're trying to save it. They capture Data.
Poor Data. He's being slowly seduced by the Borg Queen.
And getting a skin grafts.
Yeah. So apparently to be human, you need to actually feel. You actually have sensation of touch.
Well, I think he had sensation of touch. But we'll get into that later.
Yeah, we will get into that later. But So Data's out of commission. It's just basically Kirk, some of the crew members that are still left on the Enterprise, and obviously down on the planet, they're helping Zefram Cochrane. Now, here's the part where I get a little bit like, this is kind of meddling with time continuum, is you got the Enterprise crew basically helping Zefram Cochrane get the Phoenix ready for launch. Is this not a conflict of interest? Or does this mean that this always did happen? It's just that it was never written down.
The first time it happened, it didn't. But every single time after it, when it happened again and again.
Or maybe it always happened. Maybe it always happened that way.
But the chicken's got to come first. And then the egg comes, and then it's the egg every single time after that. So the first time it's got to be done one way.
I hope. Or Zefram Cochrane doesn't deserve probably one lick of his adoring fans.
It'd be a statue of Geordi and Riker looking out into the distance. Who are these guys?
Holding hands.
With a reading rainbow.
Oh, there you go. Reading rainbow. And then Jonathan Frakes, with some girl around in his other arm.
Or two.
Or two. Or seven.
That becomes a little bit gratuitous for a statue, though.
Statue's pornographic. All right, so they basically get the Phoenix up and running. They do the final launch. We have in the cockpit, it's not just Zefram Cochrane anymore. We've got Riker and
Geordi.
Geordi's
it was name. Supposed to be Lily, but Lily's up on the Enterprise with Jean-Luc Picard.
Yeah, that's right.
She is stopping his one-man angst against the Borg, she, after Picard and Worf had a face-off, she goes in, quotes something from Moby Dick, which he actually had never read.
Right.
Picard to change his mind, and then Picard and Worf get the make-up.
Right, right. So
they decide to destroy the ship because It's the Star Trek movie. The ship's got to be in danger.
We got to blow the ship up somehow. So they get the ship. The ship is ready to be destroyed. There's a countdown to destruction. The Borg Queen is trying to get the codes from Data by slowly assimilating him into a Borg or some sort of King Borg. I don't know what exactly you want to call him, but
basically the Data equivalent of Locutus.
Right. Right. So then what happens is we have Picard coming into going down to the Borg.
Yeah, he's giving himself up so that he can become Locutus again for 5 seconds before the ship blows up.
And the Queen says, "I don't want your busted ass anymore. I got a Data."
And who's going to be way more immortal than you'll be?
Yeah, exactly. I don't have to like pump chemicals into your blood to keep you going.
Oh, but you know, she's going to have to do that with Data now that she's like, you know, giving him skin grafts.
That's true. Yeah, right.
Why do they? That's so much more maintenance.
I don't understand the full thing about that, but
she's trying to help him become human, which is what he's always wanted, because Data always wants to be human.
Right. He's the biggest Pinocchio you ever meet. So they're going to launch torpedoes and destroy the Phoenix. Data it basically looks like he's turned on Picard, and at the last minute you realize that he has tricked the Queen, and that's when they go into action. And they melt all the organic material
with the nice plasma coolant that's cooling the warp drive. Why is that there? Why doesn't that have a permanent shield around it?
Yeah,
it's just a little bit of glass.
Just a little bit. Yeah.
But that scene is just so weird. Like Picard's coming in there trying to like you know mess with the Queen's mind, pretending to be I'll come and be you know, you're Locutus again, and then Data's like messing with Picard's head and the Queen's head by like pretending to go along with the Queen and deactivating the self-destruct and firing 3 quantum torpedoes at the Phoenix. I don't think it needed 3 quantum torpedoes.
You just want to make sure it really was destroyed. Well, there's another... he did mention to Picard at one point he was tempted, like he was going to go over to her side. It was like a joke. It's like, you know, like whatever he said, like some nanoseconds or something like that.
It's like, but for an android, that's an eternity.
But you wonder, maybe that was a fabrication. Maybe it was a little more than that. Maybe he was kind of thinking about it for a while. He's like, yeah, you know, screw these humans. I can do a lot better.
No, he's devoted his whole life against it. And he did have that run with the Borg whenever he was with his brother Lore. So they kind of like, you know, he kind of had that phase where he was like, paddling with the Borg and
going out for drinks.
I think he got over it.
Going out for drinks with the Borg. You shall be assimilated. So will you.
And so will this Jack Daniels.
Do you want to come to my place?
Show's brought to you by Jack Daniels.
Do you want to come to my place? You and me. Wink, wink.
Your all biological right. distinctiveness will be added to our own.
All right, I'm not going to go any further. Anyways, so we got to keep this somewhat G-rated. So that's basically first contact. So we have the Zefram Cochrane from the original series and the movie. There are some slight disparities with the character itself. Here we have the Zefram Cochrane of First Contact. You have a guy who's...
booze hound and a womanizer.
Yeah.
He's just like, you know, I just want to be rich. I just want to live on an island filled with a bunch of...
Naked women
and... just be rich and just, you know, be fond over. Like, he has got so little ambition in life other than just being rich.
Right. And then the Zefram Cochrane we meet in the original series, very mellow, you know, has a pretty good heart, even though he's, you know, a little xenophobic with the aliens.
Yeah, that just kind of floored me, because I would figure since he was the first one to meet aliens and you know, be introduced to all this new stuff, that he would be totally on board that stuff.
I don't have a problem with, like, you know, Vulcans and humans being friends, but, you know, dating them? That's out of the question.
I bet he changed his tune the first time he saw an Orion.
Yeah, he was like, dating a green woman.
This I can get behind.
Well, so there is a bit of difference. I think basically they went back and they were looking for something they could pull as a kind of a trivia card to the poll for anybody who was into Star Trek before. And like, oh, Zephyr Karkin, I remember that guy.
But the funny thing is, First Contact didn't start off that way.
Oh, really?
First Contact, the people making the movie, Rick Berman and, Ronald D. Moore, they kind of came together, and one of them was like, yeah, let's do a time travel movie. The other one's like, hey, let's do a Borg movie. And then they kind of meshed the ideas together. Funny thing is, there was a couple time periods they were actually thinking about having the movie take place in. One of them was the American Civil War.
Oh, could you imagine that?
Is someone going to like assassinate Lincoln and have to like pretend to be Lincoln to finish it?
Like, you know it'd be Patrick Stewart. They put like a fake beard on him and he'd give like the Gettysburg Address or something.
That would have been bad. Also, they were talking about doing set in the Roman Empire and having Picard in a toga, and I think that would have been dumb.
That would have been terrible.
They also talked about doing it in the time of the Renaissance and having Data pal around with Leonardo da Vinci.
Right.
And I'm just like, but it's still like, they're going through time trying to find the Borg. And I'm just kind of like, and then they decided on doing Zefram Cochrane, and they originally wanted just Zefram Cochrane to basically be out of commission the whole time. And, fight the Borg and get the Phoenix fixed without him.
Right.
And then they decided to go back and do what we actually saw.
Right, right.
And so it's really interesting, the history of it. I mean, we almost didn't have a Metamorphosis sequel, prequel.
Prequel, right. Whatever you want to call it, right. Yeah, that's pretty cool. I guess it comes down to any kind of movie. Is like it would be neat to have like a jump around time and have them do different things, but it's just like at the end, you just need to get to like to get the audience all on one page. And Zefram Cochrane was a great person that I think the average person who's not a Star Trek fan could latch on to and go like, I identify with that. I got an uncle like that.
Who's always drunk.
My dad's like that. He's always drinking and boozing it up. And he's the worst. Embarrasses my girlfriends.
Hits on my girlfriends.
Hits on my girlfriends.
You look very pretty today.
And I don't have time to argue about time. We don't have the time.
We don't have time. Wow. But so it was a good choice, I think, in the end. And out of all the Star Trek movies, First Contact, I always thought, was probably one of the better ones that were made, especially of the Next Generation.
The only good Next Generation movie, in my opinion. Well, but we'll probably talk about that later.
We will talk about that some other time. But it is one of those movies that is probably at one of the top three or four of the best Star Trek movies.
It is definitely excellent. I liked it a whole lot. Very interesting. Love the Borg. Borg is always a good... a good place to go, and the Borg didn't have a queen until the very end. Even the early script with the Borg, they were just going to be faceless automatons, and they decided someone was complaining that the Borg were too zombie-like, and they had always kind of described them as bugs, so they decided to give them a queen in the film.
Right,
so they
but that's the one thing I always felt that, I've had a lot of actually friends that took issue with the Borg Queen itself, that the Borg Queen was, kind of went against what the Borg were supposed to be originally. Like just that there was no designation between, this guy, to the one Borg to the other.
It's a hive mind, and
there has to be a hierarchy.
The Ant Queen basically controls the other ants with pheromones and whatnot, and the ants work together in amazing, agility, accuracy, they work together.
Right.
Their goals are one.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I don't mind the Borg Queen.
It makes sense.
I don't mind the Borg Queen, but I remember when the Borg Queen was kind of introduced and a lot of people took some issues with it.
Yeah, there's... someone's going to have issues.
Everyone's a critic.
With everything. And that's kind of what we are.
So, yeah, at some points, more critical than other things, but... So, yeah, First Contact, great movie. Metamorphosis, maybe.
Okay episode.
Okay episode, maybe not the best
episode. Not the best, not the worst. There's definitely things less watchable in the original series than that.
Yeah, especially when you get to third season, it gets a little rough at some points.
The character of Zefram Cochrane, which was suggest that we talk about. So now that we've kind of recapped both movies and had our side tangents, we can really kind of dig into his character a little bit. And, you know, we already have a little bit, but Zefram Cochrane, he... two very different people between the two. And maybe it was 150 years of, you know, being by himself and having to go through withdrawal.
his alcohol withdrawal.
And whatever other drugs he was probably doing.
Yeah, I imagine all the drugs he'd be on when he gets to other planets, too. He's like, oh, you got that?
Oh, yes. Plumeek soup. It's probably highly addictive to humans.
Yeah, right. Or humans. Or the, you know, the mushrooms of Alpha Centauri. This is going to make me trip. So, yeah, we don't really know. There's a big time gap between it. But what we do know is that, so he was born sometime in the 2030s, where we meet him the first time in First Contact is that sometime in the 2063 when they make First Contact?
2063.
Yeah, April 5th, 2063, which that's the First Contact date. And then we don't really know much what happens between that time. We do know that he leads up to the...
building of the Warp 5 engine. We see him in Enterprise.
In Enterprise, we see him. And
it seems like it's a recording. He seems like he's more eloquent than he was before. In First Contact.
He dried out.
Maybe a little bit.
So,
or at least first public appearances.
Or maybe the doctor says, if you keep drinking like this, you'll be dead in a year. So besides that, we do know that he was friends with Captain Jonathan Archer's father, who helped design the warp engine. So they were, and even I think Jonathan Archer said that he had met Zefram Cochrane as a young child.
Yeah.
So it was like, so the character was around at that point as well. And then somehow he gets shuffled off to Alpha Centauri senior living home, and where he's an old man, and he decides, I'm not going out like this. I'm going to shoot myself out into space again, and I'm just going to die out in space, and they'll find me like in some kind of like metal sarcophagus just floating out in space.
Yeah, and so he goes to die alone, and then the companion takes him. I just can't see him wanting to die alone, because, you know, his biggest ambition was just to be surrounded
he was always running
and money.
Yeah, but he's always run. Maybe he got all that. And, you know, as you recall in the episode, I mean, not the episode, but in the First Contact, he's always running away from everybody. He just wants to be left alone. It's like, leave me alone. I don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to build a warp engine. You know, I just want money. Now he's got fame and money.
You know. It's strange that he didn't want fame, but he wanted the money.
Right.
And like I said earlier when we were talking about Metamorphosis and, you know, him telling Kirk to leave me alone, don't anyone come back, don't tell anyone about me, that's the only thing I think that's really consistent between the character of Zefram Cochrane is that he wants to be alone, except he doesn't.
Right. So Zefram Cochrane wants to be left alone, a bit of an eccentric genius, and... I don't know. He's a conflicted character for sure. But, you know, I guess that's true from any kind of genius of any kind of level. You always see these people who are like, you know, have lots of issues. They want to be alone, or they're very strange in some way.
I just wish we had more to draw on from Zefram Cochrane, because, I mean, he's in a two-hour movie, but he's only on the screen for like 30 minutes maybe. And then he's in, you know... Metamorphosis, and he's only in, you know, it's a 55-minute episode back in the day, and, you know, he's not really the main character, so we only have, like, maybe an hour and change of Zefram Cochrane to really know. I kind of wish we had more,
right,
more from him so we could...
Well, he is sort of definitely a side character. You don't really, you know, it was interesting that they went back and they used him again for First Contact. But he is he's a strange character. I think he's just an eccentric person. You know, he's sort of he's way out there. He's got some wild ideas, obviously fueled by capitalism. But other than that, I think what happens is the strange thing is probably what happens is when they end up Earth becoming more closer to the Federation, you know, where they, you know, eliminate poverty, they eliminate, you know, money and, you know, all sorts of things, like everyone has food and everything like that. I think it just, like, he was waiting for that big royalty check and it just never came.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Poor guy.
But it would just, I don't know, it's kind of difficult analyzing a character from such small amount of time. Because in Star Trek, we could probably spend hours analyzing Picard or Kirk, because we've got such a wealth of information on them, but Zefram Cochrane's kind of a challenge, because we don't really have that much information on him, and the information we do have on him is kind of conflicting.
Yeah. He is an interesting character, and I really enjoy that he is someone kind of like in the Star Trek lore. That's kind of tucked between the pages, and you can go back and look at that once in a while. It's a cool idea.
And he's a flawed man, and obviously, and you know, he did something that was great that inspired so many people in that fictional universe.
Yeah, and that's another thing that the great thing about especially First Contact, that you know they have all these like great quotes from him, and he basically is like, you know, who said that crazy stuff? And it was basically came down to is like, I guess you can, you know, make somebody seem bigger in life, especially coming from a history book.
Yeah, and the history books are written, and we were talking earlier today before recording the episode, kind of like getting some ideas, and I was like, maybe he just was never eloquent, and the guy who wrote the history book just came back and was like, well, I'm going to make this sound really pretty.
Yeah, like he's got one of those ghostwriters when he's doing his biography or something like that, you know, make him sound like really smart and you know.
Well, he would have had to been if he invented warp drive, but he doesn't come across that way on screen.
I don't think just being smart doesn't make you eloquent. You know, you can be a real, you know, crude person, you know, so, you know, especially coming from Bozeman, Montana. So.
Oh, fun place. Go visit sometime.
Go for the missile silos.
They're very scenic, especially when they're open. Don't fall in.
The songs of the missile silos.
I'm sure that's a band.
Oh, man, there should be a band like that.
Or at least a song.
There you go. Cool, man. So there we have Zefram Cochrane. That's a pretty in-depth, I think, from a character that we don't really have much more information in canon, at least.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure there's probably more, you know, fan stuff written, probably around the Enterprise timeline and books and whatnot. I'm unfamiliar with them, if there are, but I'm sure there are. Yeah. And this was a, you know, like we said a couple times, Frank Wu came to us wanting to hear our thoughts on this. And, you know, on the Facebook group, come out and, you know, tell us what you want to hear about. Because, I mean, we're going to come up with our own ideas for topics and whatnot. But if you guys want to hear about something specifically, we'll be more than happy to dig into it and, you know, talk about it and, you know, give you guys what you want to hear. Because, I mean, that's ultimately what we're here for, to have, you know, people want to hear us, and you know, if you want to hear something specific, we'll do our best to bring it to you.
If there's like something you want to talk about, a specific character, something that happened in one of the episodes, or maybe something that doesn't make sense, maybe we could talk more about it. And then, you know, you can either, you know, message us on the Facebook page, you can send us an email, you can tweet us, either one of those. That'd be great. We encourage that.
Most definitely. And going back to what we were talking about with Data, here's this.
You are the most beautiful woman in the galaxy. You don't know how long I've wanted to tell you that.
But you're afraid.
Yes.
Of me?
Of us, of what we might become. Then you're inviting me in.
I'm not sending you away.
That's more than I expected.
Is it as much as you hoped?
To hope is to recognize possibility. I had only dreams.
Dreams can be dangerous.
Not these dreams. I dream of a galaxy where your eyes are the stars and the universe worships the night.
Careful. Putting me on a pedestal so high you may not be able to reach me.
Then I'll learn how to fly. You are the heart in my day and the soul in my night.
We lost two more relays. I can't!
Shut up, kid.
Well, like we were talking about with Data and the Borg Queen. Data knew the last time the Borg Queen came to him and was like, you know, when was the last time you had any relations? And he was like, you know, it's been, you know, a little bit over 8 years, referencing his drunken romp with Tasha.
Again, I find this hard to believe in the future that there wasn't a couple women that want to take take Data out for a spin, you know, just for fun.
And, you know, he did have that girlfriend for a while on The Next Generation. That whole episode centered around it. And I'm pretty sure the 8 years was referencing Tasha. The Borg Queen, I think, the whole thing with the Borg Queen and Data was all about seduction.
Right.
You know, she couldn't interface with Data any other way.
Right, right.
Like, she couldn't really, you know, they kept trying to probe the positronic mind.
To get the codes from the ship.
With technology, and they couldn't do it. So she had to use her Borgy feminine wilds.
Borgy.
On Data. And, you know, this is almost a twofer, because, you know, I would call this a Borg Queen fail, because she failed to realize how much Data wasn't really human, and for the seduction wouldn't really work.
But, you know, they don't really show. I mean, obviously, she grabbed the skin on his face. They grabbed the skin on his arm.
She blows on it.
We see that.
Like some candles.
But there could have been some things off screen. You know, she might have grabbed skin someplace else.
And Data said he's fully functional and knows several techniques.
But here's the thing for me. This is Borg Queen. You know, she's only, like, basically up to the chest, and then it's just a spinal column that kind of, like, locks into a like, a metal body. Like, she doesn't get any pleasure off any of that. I mean, other than,
I mean, what do the Borg need with any kind of, you know, like, sexual reproduction when they can just stick a couple tubes in you with their fist, and then, oh, look, you're one of us now.
Right, right. But isn't that sex in the end?
Yeah. That's the quickest I've ever heard of.
Stick you with a couple tubes and you're one of us now. So the Borg Queen, it is kind of a strange one that she was trying to appeal to Data on a sexual level, on a level where she's trying to seduce him. It's interesting for the Data character, but I don't know if that really, really works for Data.
I mean, you know,
obviously didn't.
I mean, yeah, it didn't. Then he's obviously curious because he didn't turn down Tasha when it was offered, and maybe he was curious, like, yeah, how's the Borg do it? But
how do you do it in your neck of the woods?
But it's just
on Vulcan. It sucks. They're just rubbing fingers together.
Only every seven years. So, you know, Data, I don't know why she was trying to appeal to that part of Data. I mean, I guess it's the only thing she had to use, but it just...
Yeah, and it's one of those things, like, maybe she just, like, she read up on all the human books, and then she's like, well, an android's based off a human, so they probably have the same type of programming. But in the end, Data's not tempted by that, you know? I mean, where maybe anybody else would have, you know, Picard, you know, Riker, definitely Riker.
Riker would have, if it was Riker, Riker would have probably.
Here's the codes. Whatever you want.
Riker.
He's like, no, leave the body. I just want your head in the spinal column.
It's one of those things. So, you know, this was a nice twofer. You know, Data, it seemed like Data, you know, scored with the Queen, and the Queen failed by not realizing that Data is incorruptible.
Yes, there's nothing that can make Data change his mind about his feelings with Captain Picard.
Because they're the Kirk Spock of this series.
Something like that. But... yeah, so there we go.
Well, guys, thank you all for listening. Like I said, this was a great idea from one of our listeners. Please chime in with any ideas and thoughts you guys have. We'd love to discuss them and, you know, get you excited about hearing about what you want to hear about. So thank you guys again so much for listening. live long and prosper.
Thank you for listening. All our music is provided by Warp 11. You can find them at warp11.com or follow them on Twitter at warp11. You can find us online at synthaholics.com. You can email us at synthaholics@yahoo.com. Our Twitter is at synthaholicduo. If you want to follow us individually, you can follow me at David_J_Duncan and Aaron at Blackbird2004. If you liked our podcast, please subscribe to us on iTunes. We can also be found on Stitcher. Please tell your friends about the show. Also, if you could leave us a review and a rating, that would help us out so much. It'll help us learn how to improve so we can reach more of our fellow Trek fans. We'd love to hear your feedback. Live long and prosper. He was a young Starfleet doctor, about fell off his rocker. When is the sign he came in? Country boys born and raised at the stars we did gaze. The next morning he left stinking of gin. Well, McCoy, my boy, come mix me a drink. Before the night's over, I'll puke in the sink. And we'll cry till we laugh, and we'll both shit our pants. You're the best drinking friend I ever had.
No, you're the best drinking friend I ever had.
Zephron, me and you will be friends forever.
You're
the guy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Zephron wanted Troy to be his best drinking friend.
Yeah, that Lily girl, I'm tired of her. She just always sassing me. I gotta get a nice Betazoid woman that knows how I feel. Know how drunk I've been.
By being that drunk herself.
That man, his thoughts are so all over the place.